to another edition of The Spirit Revolution with Philip Coppens.
And Kathleen McGowan.
Our special guest today is Jeff Stray, who is a writer, author, and researcher who lives in Glastonbury. And he has ended up in Glastonbury because of a lifelong fascination with the alternative field. And specifically, he is one of the great scholars on the 2012 debate.
Those of you who are familiar with Philip's brilliant DVD on 2012, Jeff is his co-star in that particular DVD, and just really is, he's so knowledgeable, he's so interesting, he has so much to say, it's just listening to him is a real joy for me.
Jeff, welcome to The Spirit Revolution.
Well, thank you very much, William.
You are one of those people who have been looking at the 2012 phenomena for a very long period of time. What I admire in you is that you're an observer and interpreter rather than somebody who just has opinions or ideas. And you have been carefully analyzing the 2012 phenomena for a long period of time. Your website is diagnosis2012.co.uk, and we will put that on the website for people. And you've also written several books on the 2012 phenomena. Your most recent one is Beyond 2012, which has been published by Inner Traditions. Beyond 2012 is really one of those books which is a very good introduction to people who want to know anything about the 2012 phenomenon, because it kind of weighs all the various theories and reduces everything to its proper core and its proper foundation, and also where some of these ideas sometimes come from. And you also feature together with me on a DVD which is called 2012, The Mayan Prophecies and the Shift of the Ages, and which is available from Amazon and various other outlets. So, Jeff, you've been looking at the 2012 phenomenon, and in recent years, as 2012 approaches, it's becoming much more prominent. What to you is the 2012 phenomenon?
It's a coming together of various prophecies, for one thing, ancient prophecies, with contemporary visions, people who've had altered states of consciousness in today's world have also been having visions concerning year 2012, which seem to back up what the ancient prophecies say. And then you have the ancient calendars, which is another component of the whole thing. Then another thing is modern attempts to kind of explain what all this means, to come up with theories as to exactly what might happen in 2012. So there's several different components that go into all this. I first came at this from reading Terence and Dennis McKenna's Invisible Landscapes, and basically as a result of a vision that they shared down in the Ecuador rainforest after taking some hallucinogenic plants. They had the idea that, or they were given the information that everything that happens in the universe is encoded in the ancient Chinese oracle, the I Ching. They then, by a complex process, converted that information into a graph and then had to try and find out where we were on the graph. And once they had correlated the graph with history, they concluded that the whole thing comes to a full stop sort of thing on the 17th of November 2012. And that's what got me interested in this whole thing in the first place. But it was another 5 years of studying that book before I discovered that another civilization from the other side of the world, which is the Maya, the ancient Maya, they also had a different kind of system, totally unconnected to the Chinese system. And the Maya system was a solar-based calendar, whereas McKenna had shown that the I Ching was probably a lunar-based system originally. So you've got a lunar system and a solar system from two opposite sides of the world, and they have the termination points within 34 days of each other, even though one of them, the I Ching, is over 4,000 years old, and the Maya calendar is well over 2,000 years old. That's the first sort of convergence of two factors that originally got me fascinated with this.
You use the term termination point when you're talking about both of those cultures. Can you explain that a little bit? I mean, what that really means, first in the Chinese culture and also in the Mayan culture, when they say termination point, is that just strictly this is where it ends, or where do we take that?
Well, first of all, this whole I Ching angle is an interpretation that originates mainly with Terence McKenna rather than his brother, Dennis. For people that use the I Ching and are familiar with the I Ching or I Ching, it's not immediately obvious how 2012 fits into it unless you've studied McKenna's particular interpretation and mathematical analysis of the I Ching. as regards the time wave, it's called the time wave, this graph that he produced from the I Ching. As regards that, the termination, the concept of termination point is really McKenna's interpretation here rather than the Chinese culture itself. But the implication for McKenna was that having produced this graph, it only hits the baseline is basically maximum novelty, new things and acceleration into a situation where at the baseline where novelty reaches its maximum level. And the graph only hits that baseline twice, and that's at the beginning of time and the end of time. So McKenna saw this sort of what I've been calling the termination point as a sort of maximum novelty, or what he called maximum novelty ingression into space-time. With the Maya calendar, it is a little bit different. When I say termination point, I'm talking about the end of a cycle, because in Maya time philosophy, everything is cyclical. And you've got cycles within cycles within cycles. And the cycle that we're concerned with here is called the 13 Bacton cycle, which is made up of 13 cycles of each one's called a Bacton of around 400 years each. So the 13 Bacton cycle is around 5,125 years from 3114 BC to 2012. You know, if you look at Maya mythology, it seems that this is the fifth of a series of cycles, and that there's no real reason why there shouldn't be a sixth cycle. In fact, you know, comparing it with other nearby time philosophies like the Hopi, they've got a definite continuation on of these cycles. So there's no reason to suppose that it is the end of the world, as everybody's trying to label it.
When we look at this Mayan calendar from 3114 BC to 2012, why did they choose those specific two dates? What is the importance to them? And this has always been interpreted specifically in like the popular culture that the Mayans were trying to tell the world something about what was going to happen in 2012, the so-called Mayan prophecy. So what is that in your interpretation? And also, what is it not in your interpretation?
That's a big question. There's several parts to it. Well, first of all, a lot of people presume, I mean, there's various presumptions people have made about all this, and we have to be clear, first of all, that the Maya didn't, they backdated, well, like we backdated the beginning of our calendar to the birth of Christ, they backdated, as far as the archaeologists know, they backdated their calendar from when they first developed it to a beginning point, but they've also sort of looked forward to the end point, so that there's two schools of thought on whether on which of those two is the most important, whether it was the beginning point that had some astronomically significant event or whether it's the end point. Somebody who's done a lot of very good work on this subject is John Major Jenkins. And he's looked at all the loads and loads of work that's been done over the last 100 years by various specialists looking into Maya studies, Mayanists we could call them. Jenkins realised that's encoded into the king accession rites, the actual design of the ball game rings, the mythology and the calendrical systems, is some astronomical, there's an astronomical event which actually seems to be the reason why they chose 2012 as the end point. So in other words, Jenkins's interpretation sees that they chose those cycle dates specifically around the end point rather than the beginning point. Now, what he's identified there is that the day on which this cycle ends, which is the winter solstice 2012, 21st of December, the sun at that time will be rising on the galactic plane. That's the midpoint. If you draw a line down the middle of the Milky Way galaxy, the galactic equator, the winter solstice sun is right on that line on that date, 21st of December 2012. But, I mean, this is immediately, you have to define this, because if you don't define it in a very detailed way, then astronomers will come along and try to knock down the whole thing. But basically, the sun is half a degree wide. It takes 36 years for it to actually move half a degree across the sky. So it takes 36 degrees when it's touching one side of the galactic equator to when it crosses it and it finishes touching on the other side. So, but we also have to be clear that this is just an alignment that's only visible from the Earth. So it's not the whole solar system moving from one side of the galaxy to the other, as some people have tried to have interpreted this. But it's just an alignment of the Sun on that particular day with the galactic equator, and what it is measuring is the precession of the equinoxes. But they're measuring it not by the equinox as the Greeks and we do, they're measuring it by the winter solstice, but it's exactly the same cycle, the 26,000 year rotation of the Earth's pole is actually the Earth's axis, where we talk about the dawning of the age of Aquarius. That's because the constellation that's behind the equinox sun on the equinox day has been Pisces for the last 2,000 years, but it's being replaced by Aquarius, so it's slowly slipping in the opposite direction to the direction in which the sun travels. That's the exact same cycle that the Maya were measuring with this event, this sun being on the galactic equator as being the significant point. So the next question is, what does that mean for us? I mean, that's Jenkins is now really likes to separate that into two things, because he's reconstructing what the Maya thought. Whether or not that has any bearing on what actually happens is another question. But his reconstruction of the Maya way of thinking is getting more and more evidence backing it up all the time, actually. And he is actually starting to get some support from some academics now, but they haven't really come out yet on this. But that's the end point. Then, of course, you've got the question of what could have, the other school of thought is, was there something at the beginning of the cycle in 3114 BC? Well, there was something called the Piura Oscillation, which is in some ice cores taken from, some of which are taken from Tanzania, and there's one other place which I've forgotten at the moment, but two specific places where they've taken ice cores, it shows this climate oscillation around about that time, 3114 BC, 3100, around there, and it seems to be a pretty worldwide sort of flooding from what we can tell. So, there's this school of thought that says the thing was dated from the end point. Another school of thought says it was dated from the beginning point. But as for what it means for us, then again, you've got several schools of thought coming in. If you're taking Jenkins's interpretation, which is the one I do prefer, because the whole thing is immediately associated with the Maya calendar. Jenkins's work on it is the most extensive and detailed work, and he does seem to have some very good points and is now getting academic support. So the question is, does this galactic alignment actually have any effect that might fulfill or be what these prophecies were all about? Well, there's two pieces of scientific research that sort of actually go towards that interpretation. One of them is the work of Simon Schnoll, where when he was a student, he was looking into biochemical reaction rates and biochemical radioactive decay rates and biochemical reaction rates. And he did more and more experiments, and the graph should have smoothed out into a bell curve, but it actually started producing spikes. And he didn't understand it. He asked his professor, and his professor said, oh, don't worry about it, you're doing too many experiments. But then over the years, he's carried this on in his spare time as a sort of hobby. And then when computers came out, he was able to get all this information on the database and realize that these spikes actually indicate certain astronomical cycles. One of them is the 27-day Carrington rotation of the sunspots. Another one's a sidereal day, and the third one is a sidereal year. So that's sidereal means a rotation of the Earth in respect to the stars rather than the sun. There's a slight difference there. But the implication is that our biochemistry is affected by the position of the Earth in relationship to stars, and all the stars we can see are in the Milky Way. So the implication is that, our angling towards the Milky Way could have some effect on our biochemistry. Now, the second scientific result that has some bearing on this is some work that was done by James Spottiswood, who was looking at extrasensory perception. And he found that no matter where he did this experiment on the Earth with measuring people's ESP rates, the moment that galactic center comes over the horizon, people's ESP abilities would rapidly rise and become much more significant. So, in other words, this piece of research shows that our relationship to, or our, the angle that we're forming towards galactic center, which is where this conjunction of the Sun and the galactic equator is right next to astronomical galactic center, that could also have a bearing on our actual abilities to our paranormal abilities, in other words, ESP and other paranormal abilities could be increased or affected by a relation to the centre of the galaxy. So those are two bits of solid sort of scientific research that seem to indicate that there could be a side effect of this actual galactic alignment process, as Jenkins calls it. But then, you know, we've got lots and lots of other people who've come up with other ideas as to what this might be. And my own particular favourite, I'll get into that in a minute, but the idea is, rather than seeing the explanations of all these ancient prophecies and modern visions being an actual side effect of the alignment process itself, it could be that they've used, or the ancient Maya used that as a sort of celestial clock, a 36-year time window in which something happens, and that their long calendar endpoint, or the termination of this 13 Bacton cycle, or the turnover point of it, was put specifically in winter solstice 2012 or around there somewhere, in order to indicate the point during that window when something else occurs, which is what the prophecies are all about. So, to get into what I think that might be, and why. Okay, shall I go into that now?
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing, I want to talk a little bit about some of these things that are in your book in relation to this, like some, you know, what you just said about the potential for heightening our psychic awareness. I want to step back in a minute and talk about something really amazing that I discovered in your book last night that pertains to what's happening right now, which is this whole concept of what people were seeing in near-death experiences in 1992, and this idea that from 1992 to 2012, there is this extraordinary period of growth. And so that's something I definitely want to hear you talk about some more.
Yes, first of all, the Alexei Dmitriev is a Siberian geologist, and he wrote a paper called The Planetophysical State of the Earth and Life. And in that, he showed that the Russians have for some time been sending probes to different to the edge of the heliosphere, which is the point where the solar system travels through interstellar space. The edge of the solar wind on the outside of the Earth, where all the planets are, is called the heliosphere. And as that goes through interstellar space with the edge of the whole solar system, they've measured this huge buildup of deflected interstellar plasma on the edge of the heliosphere. It's about 1,000% increase over a decade or so. And Dmitriev said that really this explains not only the climate change that we're having on Earth, but it turns out that these climate changes in atmosphere and magnetics are happening throughout the whole solar system, and particularly on the outer planets like Uranus and Neptune, who've had about a 50-degree magnetic field switch recently, a change in the magnetic field orientations. So he's saying that this deflected plasma on the edge of the heliosphere is bleeding through and causing all these changes to all the planets, including the Earth, and ramping up the sun's. The sun has been getting more active until its very recent lack of sunspot activity, which is again completely out of character. But all these things seem to be explained by this this buildup of plasma, and Dmitriev says that this plasma buildup will cause a mass spontaneous evolution of mankind and will also trigger off a geomagnetic reversal. That's a reversal of the Earth's magnetic field. Now, what you just brought up about near-death experiences, particularly what Daniel Brinkley said, I find it very interesting, that story, because what Brinkley's described from his near-death experience, the vision he had of things that, I mean, this is a vision that happened in 1975, and he was given visions of events, world-class events, from 1975 up to 2014. And what is described is, and this was before Dmitriev brought out his scientific explanation for all this, it's virtually the same idea. I mean, it's the same thing, but they're totally disconnected from each other. What Brinkley saw, there was 300 scenes from the future, 117 major world events, and by 2002, most of those had come to pass, including Chernobyl and the Iraq War, and leaving only about 17 left between then and 2014 to come to pass. And he said between 2011 and 2012, the Earth changes would reach a climax. And between 2012 and 2014, there would be a geomagnetic reversal, and that it will be connected with the influx of an energy that hadn't been in this part of the galaxy for a long time, and it would cause an evolutionary opportunity for mankind. And all those aspects are exactly what Dmitriev said in his scientific explanation of the influx of interstellar plasma into the solar system. We have, you know, the actual plasma itself coming in is what Brinkley said is this energy that hasn't been here for a long time. And then you've got the geomagnetic reversal, exactly the same in both Dmitriev and Brinkley's scenarios. And then you've got the evolutionary opportunity for mankind, as Brinkley put it, and then Dmitriev's version was a mass spontaneous evolution of mankind. And it just seems to be two parallel things from totally different areas that seem to be explaining this. And that's why I think that this is my favourite explanation for what might be going on, rather than it being a direct side effect of galactic alignment, but that maybe the ancient Maya shamans, using their shamanistic techniques, travelled forward in time, got the visions about what is going to be happening around this time with Earth changes and an evolutionary shift, a jump in consciousness, but that they were aware of what was going on in the sky as well, and they used that as a timing point. That the galactic alignment, I think, as a sort of timing point to specifically mark the end of the calendar.
So actually what we're saying is that they looked at the sky, they saw a pattern of astrology present there and realized that behind that pattern there were certain effects that astrology, as we've defined it in the West, they also figured it out in the New World, and that this is why they created this calendar and pinpointed specifically this date, which in the Western mindset kind of like comes across as the Age of Aquarius, which has been going on for a number of decades in the West as well. Now, when you talk about change in, like evolution, all of these things, those sound to be pretty good, but at the same time, you're talking about geomagnetic reversal, and when people have been confronted with movies like 2012, there's lots of scary stuff, and Kathleen has got examples, and we have examples together, and of children specifically who are all of a sudden terrified and believe that the world is going to end in 2012. So what's your message on that one?
Well, whatever is happening here has happened before. And I also think that whatever is happening here has already started. If you look around the world, we have an increase of climate change. We've got increasing hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes, volcanoes, and that has already had some casualties. Thousands of people have already died in this. So, I mean, there's no real need for anybody to get any more panicking than they would have been had they been reading, seeing, looking at the news, really. We are fortunate so far in really that it hasn't manifested so much. I mean, well, particularly in the UK, but I mean, you do get some extreme weather events, more than we do over here. But so some people have already, died as a result of these, and that can't be denied. So, I mean, I don't think there's any great need to panic, because this has happened before, and it's a cyclical thing, you see. And
so you're saying that the phenomena comes with some disasters, with some natural calamities, but that actually they are to some extent localized, and they're not this big catastrophe of the entire world dying off as is so prominently displayed in 2012 movie.
Well, yes, the 2012 movie, funnily enough, I was watching it last night for the second time. But, yeah.
I'm sorry.
What?
You're a very courageous man, Jeff.
To watch it twice.
I mean, it's my duty. The thing is, yeah, that has really affected the public perception of this whole thing. And having looked at it for the second time, I've seen several facets of it that are now, people are asking questions specifically about things that were portrayed in that film. So, yeah, I think it's good for me to familiarise myself with it a bit more. But, it's quite a... They really tried to fit every catastrophe they could combine into one movie. It couldn't get much more catastrophic. I mean, from beginning to end, it was pretty well... non-stop catastrophe, wasn't it? But then that makes a good, a good, exciting film. But then I don't really think it has a great special relationship to reality. And, that's Hollywood for you.
I was reading through your book last night, and I love this book, Beyond 2012. I think it is excellent. I think everyone who cares about this subject should run out and buy it immediately, because there's so much information in it, and it's so readable. You know, a lot of the books out there about 2012 are not. They're, you know, a lot of them are very dense. They're kind of all over the place. Your book is special because it's so informative, but it's really entertaining. But what struck me last night, and I don't even know if you may not have even had the chance to think about this, because this is really just something from the last couple of days. I was reading through chapter 14, which is Other Altered States, when you were talking about the near-death experiences with Daniel Brinkley. But you talk about this woman named Cassandra Musgrave, who had this experience in 1992.
Yeah.
And she talks about seeing the earth changes. And I was really struck by this one thing that she says here, where she says, I was shown that there was going to be something akin to 3 days of darkness. To me, it was a feeling of natural earth disasters with the smoke from volcanoes that would block the sun. And then she goes on to say, if we have the darkness for 3 days, it will pass because we will always have the light. But certainly with what just happened in Iceland and the downing of these planes for 3 days, I thought that was very interesting.
That's a very good point, actually. Although it's not, you wouldn't really call it darkness in the normal interpretation. But, it's definitely a three-day effect, yeah.
It just cost the airline industry $800 million, so I think they might call it darkness for different reasons. But I thought it was really, really interesting. But I also think that, you know, all of these people who did have these sort of near-death experience visions about 2012 all say the same thing, which is there will be catastrophes, there will be darkness, but we will survive them, there will always be light, and we will come out of it much better than we entered into it. And I really love this whole concept of evolutionary opportunity. And I love what you're saying about the fact that the Mayans were so advanced in terms of their shamanistic culture that they could project themselves into the future and really identify this as an opportunity for us. And I think that we have the ability to learn from it or not. And I think my question for you is, in terms of practical application for the average listener who's out there trying to digest all of this 2012 information, what's your best advice? What is the one thing that you really want to say, look, here is what I believe is really useful to know about this entire phenomenon for the future?
Well, I think it is important to be optimistic wherever one can, because of the whole concept of self-fulfilling prophecies, for one thing. I mean, it's now well known that, you know, if you're ill in hospital, if you've got a positive outlook, you're much better likely to recover. So one of these near-death experiences, Ken Kalb, has said that he sees what the Earth is going through now is the Earth itself is having a near-death experience. And if you look at the work of Irvin Laszlo on Chaos Point was the main book that he brought this up in, that if you analyse the Earth's situation at the moment, and all the situations we have that are unsustainable in the world are all sort of reaching a crisis point and coming to a point where something has got to happen to turn it around. One way or another, something's got to happen, and this could be like seen as the Earth having a near-death experience. And something that Terence McKenna also said was that and this fits in very well with native prophecies, is that the whole thing is like a birth experience, because he said if an alien, say from another planet, came round the corner and saw a woman giving birth, it would look like she was in the throes of an agonizing death with a huge tumor appearing. But in fact, the whole thing would be the opposite of that. It's about life, not death. There can be some nasty side effects, but I mean, the indigenous people have been saying that what we do will minimize those side effects. Our attitude about the Earth, actually, they are saying, will minimize the necessity of these birth pangs, if you like. And that, I mean, the work of Peter Russell, based on the ideas of Teilhard de Chardin, and he has developed those ideas, indicates that we are actually, we've got a job to do, that our evolutionary role, if you like, is to perform a function as a kind of global neuron, where we actually, we're all parts of the actual functioning brain of the planet, but that at the moment we're not functioning properly, but that this birth process is a birthing of the Gaian consciousness, where we actually all start to cooperate with each other and work together in the way that we're designed to do for the benefit of the whole planet. There are various positive ways of looking at this, and I think that they all help. And that also, there's this this whole idea has come out of this, because the only real prophecy that we have from the Maya that's actually encoded, actually inscribed in stone, talks about, it's from the Tortuguero monument number 6, and it talks about that at the end of this 13 Baxton cycle in 2012, the 9 gods will return, and it does say that there will be darkness as well, and that. But that ties up with some other prophecies from the Chilambalams, which have now been shown to be originally about the 13 Baxton cycle, but then the Chilambalams apparently seem to be on the surface about a much shorter cycle, which they used later. But it seems there's some good evidence that some of these prophecies are originally about the 13 Baxton cycle, so in other words, about 2012. And again, talking about the return of these 9 gods, and I've done a study on this, actually, and the essay is on Graham Hancock's website. It was the author of the month essay for March. It's called Tortuguero Unraveled, for anyone that wants to explore that. But it shows that there's reason to think that you can look upon this return of the 9 gods as being, if you look at cultures from all across the world and the number 9 and what that means, it seems in these prophecies, it's encoded that the number 9 has to do with the levels of our own psyche and going down into our own subconscious minds and freeing up all the shadow material that's there, all the stuff which is stopping a golden age from happening. Because a golden age happens when people are compassionate and not self-centered. And all the stuff that we've accumulated and buried within ourselves, the stuff that makes us react to people, that comes out in things like road rage, that's the most obvious way it comes out, that is what is stopping a golden age from happening, and that if we can somehow do, you know, go and do various whatever appeals to us to try, you know, various psychotherapeutic techniques that are available to bring this stuff up and air it and get rid of it, disperse it, and make us, you know, more sorted, then, you know, everything is much more liable to work out for the best.
So how is this going to happen in practice? I mean, you're talking about return of nine deities as prophesied by the ancient Mayan. You're saying that there will be this change upon us, that there will be this introduction to a golden age. Now, me sitting and listening to this, what do I need to do? Do I need to just sit back and relax and do nothing? Or do I actually need to do something? And if the latter, what? What is really, what is my task, so to speak, to really bring this golden age and this better future for everybody, including myself, about?
Well, there are various kinds of psychotherapies that are available. I mean, where you can go to do workshops. For example, I did one called Being in Action, it was called. This was a weekend workshop where you have to, you know, with a group of people, and there your hope is to identify two points in your life, one during childhood and one around puberty, where something happened to you that then controls everything you do ever since. It's sort of it becomes like a switch mechanism that becomes part of your character, where you switch into an automatic responses that are often inappropriate. And so once you've actually managed to, in a group, I mean, this is just one way of going about this, you've actually managed to identify these things and air them in front of people, it helps to dissipate it and get it out of your system, and then you can then you're in control. You can choose your own reactions rather than being governed by reactions that are caused by something that happened years ago to you. And it's very, very common, this sort of, I mean, this is an idea that's a base of a lot of psychological approaches. But there are other things like rebirthing, where people do breathing techniques and then they relive their various traumatic things that have happened to them that have then are internalized and govern their responses. And of course, also your actual birth process itself can be very traumatic and cause, I mean, there's been cases of people who've been born with the cord around their neck, and that's caused them speaking problems and this sort of thing. And then reliving that process then helps to heal that wound. And there's Reichian therapy, where you've actually, people build up tensions in their muscles, and the idea is that this special kind of massage and releasing those tensions actually has a feedback effect to the actual part of the mind that it's connected up to, so that you then release the actual complexes that are associated with that. You know, there's lots of different therapies. I mean, living in Glastonbury, you get quite a few of these to choose from around here, actually.
I think you're particularly blessed to live in Glastonbury during this period of time. How did you end up in Glastonbury?
Well, over the years, I met a few people at festivals and events that live around here. And then when it came time for where I found myself in a sort of situation where I had nowhere to live, and I was living in my camper van, I just gravitated down here to the people that I know, and I didn't live in a camper van for long, but you know, I found somewhere to live, and it's a great networking place. There's lots of people who run festivals and events and conferences, and there's artists and writers and publishers. You know, it's a great place to network with people around here.
It's a magical place. How present is the 2012 phenomena in the whole Glastonbury culture right now?
They're having a few meetings about it quite regularly. I didn't go to the last one, somebody told me something about it. I've spoken here over the years. I've spoken in Glastonbury so many times. I don't do it so often now, but I will be speaking this year at the Glastonbury Symposium. They have every few months they have, or probably now it's probably every few weeks there's somebody speaking somewhere about 2012 in this area.
Do you find that the 2012 phenomenon is like less present or more present within those kind of people? It's like, you know, Glastonbury is like the English Sedona. It's like where people of a disposition to change, of becoming alternative and new ways of thinking, are already there. So it's like the 2012 phenomena less powerful, actually more powerful in a place like that?
I'd say it's more powerful because I think having this film has only come out since I've been living here. So, I mean, it's easy to get into a bit of a bubble here where you forget what it's like to be in the outside world. But here, people are much more open to these kind of ideas and, you know, what they imply. So, and it's much easier to discuss that sort of thing than in normal towns where you would... You're at risk of putting yourself in some sort of pigeonhole talking about these things, you know. Seeing as someone who's got a sandwich board on saying, whoa, the end is nigh, and all this, it's a sort of a joke that actually did come up in that 2012 movie as well.
It is.
Yeah.
Now, coming to... basically 2012. It's 2 years away. It's 2.5 years away. What is your kind of, what do you see happening specifically with the 2012 phenomenon? Because from definitely what we see in the general public, there is this fear about 2012, and almost like as if 2013 is going to come along, people will say, whew, you know, nothing to worry about, and they will just try and carry on the way they've been carrying on for the past 20, if not 30 years, if not longer. Yeah. So, do you see that happening? What is your prediction? What is a straight prediction for 2013 or 2012?
Originally, when I started looking into all this, I thought this was something that would happen over several years. Because, I mean, I've never thought it would all come to a point on one day. But that the Maya and other cultures have chosen different days throughout 2012. Like the Quero people of Peru, or the descendants of the Inca, that the day is the 1st of August for them, where this culminates in 2012. So different prophecies have a different date in 2012. I've never seen it as all one day, but when I realised that all these people were coming back from all the states of consciousness in contemporary times now, talking about 2012 specifically, and in many cases, and I have spoken to some of them, they knew nothing about it beforehand. So I'm thinking, okay, there must be a focus point throughout the year 2012. Looking back on it from a year or 2 years later, it should be easy to identify why that particular year keeps coming up in the prophecies and the visions. But I think in order to bring about this golden age, I mean, in the prophecies of the Tibetan, the Kala Chakra prophecy, it talks about the last Lama of Shambhala, the hidden kingdom in the Himalayas. His name is Rudrakakran, and he will ride out on a white horse and kill the barbarians, and then he'll inaugurate the Golden Age. Well, the people that are that have written about this, such as Birnbaum and Lepage, have said that he's talking about that this thing about killing the barbarians is what I've mentioned before about killing off this barbarian within ourselves that is stopping the Golden Age from happening. So, now what was the rest of the question?
Basically, what is going to be kind of like, you know, your prophecy for 2013? What do you see happening for the world?
So and it's quite likely that there's going to be a massive crash of the financial system and or technology, basically. Those, one of those or both of those is probably, I mean, it's going to be a terrible, a big change. You see, what people have got to do is embrace change, because I think that's inevitable. Change is inevitable. It's not going to be business as usual, even if it seems to be. And even if people try and eke out business as usual for as long as possible, we have to have change because of all these unsustainable situations that are meeting together. The world won't allow us to go on the way we are. So we have to have radical change. So the more you can embrace what Robert Anton Wilson called neophilia, the love of the new, rather than trying to keep on going on business as usual, because business as usual means that we are killing the planet. So we can't go on like that. But then again, big business will not give in. So it's got to be forced to give in by a crash of the financial system, which does seem to be getting very wobbly at the moment, and a crash of technology. Now, the possibility of a crash of technology could be brought on by a Carrington event. Now, I think it was 1789, we had a huge solar flare that was pointing at the Earth. And at that time, the only technology we had were telegraphers' equipment for sending telegrams. Well, they found that their keyboards were actually catching fire, and they were switching off the current to their machines, and they were still working with the ambient electricity that was in the air. They were still able to communicate with the machines switched off because of all the electricity in the air. And it also caused the northern lights to come down to such low latitudes that people could read newspapers in the middle of the night. So the thing is, scientists have been discussing the possibility of this recently, what with the fact that we have the next solar maximum in 2012, when this is most likely to happen. If we had something like that, I mean, I actually know an environmental scientist who lives around here who thinks it's going to happen this year. If we do, that would cause it's very likely to cause a major crashing of the electrical systems, the grid system. So you've got to be prepared to live off-grid, to basically not rely on technology, because everything that's related with technology is what is causing the damage to the planet. And I think a lot of this stuff could be the subconscious mind of the planet communicating with us, trying to tell us in various ways that we've got to make big changes. So the more we can embrace neophilia and change and different ways of doing things, the better.
Definitely on the first bit of financial crisis, and you can see that change happening. It's been happening for a number of years. As Kathleen was pointing out, we're on the brink probably of renationalizing the airline industry. So there is definitely this change away from just money for the pure making, even though I think the banks probably need to have another little kick underneath some of their parts to kind of like get that message completely. But you can see that this drive to just create and pile money on top of each other hasn't worked and is definitely changing. So once again, it doesn't seem like everything is just going to happen in 2012, but it is happening over this period, which, as you were pointing out earlier on, this period of 1836 years around which these things are happening. So times of change are already upon us.
Yeah.
Well, and I think we're seeing that with, you know, a lot of people that we know personally. We're seeing it all around us. I notice it when I'm on social media like Facebook, how many people are going through personal changes. I love what you said, Jeff, about the subconscious mind of the planet is telling us to make big changes. I think that's profound, and I think it's something that we need to think about. But in addition to the technology changes and the global economy changes, I think that every single one of us individually is being asked to make big changes. And it goes back to something you said about, you know, we can't enter a golden age until everyone is working from a place of compassion. But I think that this idea of embracing neophilia and learning how to love, you know, what is new, I think that's so exciting. And I think that's incredibly powerful. And I don't think anyone's really focusing on that. But, you know, for me, you know, one thing that I take away from this great interview is this idea that you are telling us to, you know, go out and embrace the new. We can't go on with business as usual because we will destroy ourselves and destroy the planet. But if we can embrace all the, you know, these new concepts, that we really can let the light back in and save ourselves and save the world. So, you know, I kind of want to send that shout out to a lot of people who listen to us, who have been writing to us in various places through email and Facebook to talk about how they personally are going through extraordinary changes and tell them it's okay. You're supposed to go through extraordinary changes right now. It's really what it's all about. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think PMH Atwater, who's had a lot of these NDEs, oh, she had three, I think it's two Kundalinis and three NDEs or the other way around. She's done a study of lots of people who've had NDEs and also psychic children, and finds correspondences between the change of people's consciousness and returning from the near-death experience and the consciousness that seems to be manifesting in psychic children, as if they're forerunners of a new global state of consciousness. And this is supported by Kenneth Ring's Amiga project, and when he looked at a massive number of NDE people and came to the conclusion that using Rupert Sheldrake's theory of morphic resonance, that that we'll get to this sort of critical number, a bit like the 100th monkey, where enough people in the world have had a near-death experience so that all their the massive change in consciousness that they return with from their experience becomes species wide, and they have such a turnaround. They lose their fear of death. They become totally compassionate. They start to have paranormal experiences. And Brinkley, for example, could hear people when they came into his aura. He could hear them as if they were speaking to him, but he was just hearing their thoughts. It seems from Kenneth Ring's work that we could reach a critical number when this change will become a new state of consciousness for the whole of humanity. And I've got a little a small paragraph just before the conclusion of my book, which sums up what you were just saying. Shall I just read that out?
Yes, please.
So, we could look back upon the Earth as a large hibernating creature like a bear that's recycling its body waste, but can only keep it up for a certain amount of time before it either has to wake up or poison itself. The unconscious mind of the bear knows when spring is coming, the trigger that will arouse it from its slumber, just as the year 2012 is emerging from collective unconscious as the end of time, a year of ascension, as the year of catastrophe, as the deadline for cleaning out the planet by Kyoto Protocol. As we get nearer, there should be more outbreaks of telepathy and clairvoyance, like a pan of maize on a stove that starts with a few pops and speeds up until the whole pan goes crazy.
The title of this program is called The Spirit Revolution. And basically, Jeff, what you have just been describing is a gigantic invitation for everybody to become part of the Spirit Revolution, which is happening right now, and embrace change for a better future, a better world, and a better everything. So I think we have to thank you from our heart of hearts for a wonderful interview, and also the decades of research you have been doing on the 2012 phenomenon. And all the best with 2012 and 2013.
Thanks, Philip, and thank you, Kathleen, as well.
Thank you, Jeff. It was such a pleasure to talk to you. We will have all the information about your books and the DVD on thespiritrevolution.com so people can get more information. Really, really the best products out there on this subject. Highly recommended. Thanks again, Jeff, so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, and that was another edition of The Spirit Revolution. We will be back next week.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're looking forward to 2012 and embracing all this newness. But until then, the truth against the world.